Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Welcoming back once again, former Congressman Joe Walsh, known as Woke Joe Walsh in these parts. Good to have you back, Congressman.
Hey, Charlie, it's always good to be with you, my friend.
So I'm trying to figure out where to start today. There's so much. You know, one of the questions that I asked on Twitter was, and it was a rhetorical question, why is Jacob Wohl still a thing? Now for people who are trying to keep up with the right-wing grifters, Jacob Wohl has got to be one of the strangest human beings on the world. I mean, he's this right-wing provocateur who was constantly in the news for getting caught trying to fabricate charges. He works with a guy named Jack Berkman. This guy's Jacob Wohl's an internet troll. He's screwed up everything he's touched, and he's in the news this week because he was attempting to recruit some guys to level fake allegations of sexual assault against Pete Buttigieg, Mayor Pete. And I don't know where to start on all of this, but it's like, not only does he keep doing these things, he keeps screwing them up in the most elaborate ways, and it makes you wonder, why is this guy even around? What the hell, Joe?
Well, Charlie, it's fascinating, and you're right. What I keep asking myself is, why does this guy, Jacob Wohl, get any attention at all, and why does anybody take him seriously? But I think it's got less to do with him and more of an indictment of the fact that in this age of Trump on our side, on slash the Republican conservative side, there are so many grifters and there are so many people out there who I believe are frauds that it does lend a bit of a credibility even to somebody who is beyond the pale like this guy named Jacob Wohl. I think some people take him seriously because you and I know so many other grifters who are out there.
No, and this one is, I mean, the Daily Beast broke this story. They got a surreptitious audio recording of a meeting. Wohl appears to refer to Buttigieg as a terminal threat to President Trump's reelection. So he tries to get this guy named Hunter Kelly to publish a piece in which he alleged that he'd somehow been, you know, homosexually raped or whatever. And this whole thing has fallen apart because Kelly's come out and said, no, I didn't do this. This is a fraud. This is a fake. Who knows? By the way, maybe he's out there on the far edge, but this is one of these kind of shoot me moments. I just got a press release from the Wisconsin Republican Party. I used to know these people. I really did.
And
they've invited Candace Owens of Turning Point USA to speak at the Republican convention. Now, this is the Republican Party that used to be kind of an oasis of rationality, gone full Trump, but now they're actually inviting Candace Owens from Turning Point USA. I'm sure to share her wisdom about how Nazis are bad, but not all bad, you know, that sort of thing.
Well, and Charlie, you talk about frauds. Again, Charlie Kirk, it's interesting. I was there. I knew Charlie Kirk when he was 16 years old. I helped him sort of launch and start Turning Point USA. But the moment Trump ran for president, Charlie Kirk abandoned his role, you know, as trying to espouse freedom and limited government on college campuses. And he basically went to work for Donald Trump, at which point I left Turning Point USA. But Charlie Kirk plucked this Candace Owens out of nowhere about 2 years ago. She was a hardcore lefty. She was into this doc scene where you out conservatives and Republicans. She hated Trump, but he grabbed her because he wanted a young black face to be the face of a movement to show people that, you know, young black people are really all conservatives. She's an utter fraud.
It's funny because I had met Charlie Kirk pre-Trump as well at an event sponsored by the Bradley Foundation, and there was a panel of people there, and I knew that there were some folks that were very skeptical of him. He was like 20 years old or 21 years old at the time, and I actually thought he made sense. He was trying to make an argument about what he was doing on college campuses, but you're right. It was interesting watching the trajectory where he got sucked into this vortex of whether it was celebrity power, you know, and became exactly the way you described him. And I think the moment that I saw where he was going, and I think it says a lot about what's happening conservative politics, was he tweeted out a picture of himself with James O'Keefe, who's another one of these trolls, and they had they had you know, VIP tickets to some Trump event, and I thought you could just sort of see how the stars were lining up. Well, you know, as part of that Candace Owens story, though, they put it in the shoot me category. So I see this press release and I tweet it out, you know, something snarky about Candace Owens coming to the Wisconsin Republican Party. And a friend of mine who is, I still actually have some Republican friends in Wisconsin, texted me and said, well, you know about Scott Walker's son, right? And it was no. I said, no, I didn't know.
He's back with them.
Alex Walker tweets out. And this is a kid that I've known since he was really young. And smart kid, works with his dad. He says, I'm excited to share that I've accepted a position with Turning Point USA. I'm thrilled to be joining the team that Charlie Kirk has worked tirelessly for more than 6 years to build into the incredible movement it is today, fighting for free markets and limited government. Oh, good God.
Charlie, it is an absolute shame because, look, Charlie Kirk is a very young man. And as you said, he got caught up in the bright lights. He became best friends with Donald Trump Jr., and now he's in the White House, and away he goes. But I'll tell you what, there are a lot of young people with Turning Point USA who have walked away from the organization because that organization is supposed to not be beholden to politicians, much less the one in the White House.
You know, I was, hopefully maybe he just doesn't really fully understand it, but it is the, and I've used this analogy many times, so I give credit to Jonah Goldberg. It is like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, though, you know, one person after another. But interesting, they make a reference to free markets and limited government. This is a nice segue. I was writing an editorial for The Bulwark early this morning about Richard Lugar, remembering when all the usual suspects, you know, decided that he was a rhino. And then after he was defeated in the primary, the guy who at the time was the head of the Club for Growth put out a press release saying that, you know, this was really a blow for, I think it was like fiscal responsibility, you know, a blow against deficit spending. And I thought, boy, so ironic, given the fact that we are now running trillion-dollar deficits. And I want to ask you about this. So there was a meeting today. It's Infrastructure Week again. Happy Infrastructure Week, Joe.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah, good.
And Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer come out of the meeting with Trump and they say, hey, we are really, really encouraged because we struck a deal with the president for a $2 trillion infrastructure plan. You and I remember, we're old enough to remember when Steve Bannon was saying that conservatives are going to hate him because he's going to push for a $1 trillion plan. Well, somehow in the interim, that amount of money has doubled. So happy infrastructure.
Well, the nice thing, but Charlie, the nice thing is, like with everything else Trump says, nothing will happen. And so my hope is, it's curious to me as to why Pelosi and Schumer even wanted to make the effort to try to work with him. I would imagine that Trump is probably fairly desperate because he would like a win, something, but I don't think anything's going to happen with it because, you know, again, Trump does not stand for a damn thing. This $2 trillion infrastructure plan, the same day I think you saw, my friend, where my former colleague, Mick Mulvaney, now the chief of staff, we got elected together, he was quoted today as saying that the $22 trillion debt is really no big deal. It's not holding us back at all. You talk about the invasion of the body snatchers. This guy Mulvaney, who I know well, was the biggest deficit hawk we had in Congress when I was there, and now he's gone to work for this guy, and he doesn't care about the debt.
So the question is, I suppose the 35,000 foot question is, did people ever actually care about it? I mean, I actually cared about it. I've described how I used to have Paul Ryan on my show all the time talking about it, you know, with his charts and everything. And he got me believing that it would, you know, a national debt crisis would be a bad thing. This would be a massive intergenerational transfer of wealth. And that feels like it's kind of like that was last president, because basically everybody is saying in one way or another, who cares? does not matter.
And you know what? I think you're right, Charlie. I don't think anybody cares. I don't think most Republicans cared. I know when I got elected in 2010, the Tea Party class, we went there. Mm-hmm. There was a small number of us who cared. But right away, I think we realized Paul Ryan was an exception. And I gave Ryan a lot of crap back then. For other reasons, because he was a bit too establishment for my liking. But Paul Ryan, to his credit, cared about it. The Republican Party didn't. But fast forward 8-9 years now, Charlie, where are all the Tea Party conservatives out here in Wisconsin and Illinois in the real world? They don't talk about it. And so it's natural that these Republican politicians don't even bring it up anymore.
No, it doesn't even seem to register. And of course, the Democrats are in the process of trying to outbid one another for the biggest, boldest right. idea. And it's interesting watching them there, because there's a profound unseriousness about some of the things that you hear from I could list all of them. But I mean, Bernie yeah. Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are promising these massive free giveaways. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is talking about free college tuition, universal free college tuition. That would cost about $1.25 trillion over the next 10 years minimum debt reduction. Yeah. And of course, you have universal daycare. There's probably another $1 trillion. Bernie Sanders is talking about single payer health care. And what's interesting is that they don't see, there's no practical way to get there. And yet, for some reason, voters or what the left has decided details don't matter as long as you are aspirationally proposing something big and bold.
Right. And in theory, these big and bold ideas like free college are popular. But you're right. When you get into the details, they're not. But look, I've seen enough to believe that Trump is just a blip because Trump doesn't stand for anything. I mean, I think it's safe to say that generally this country that you and I love is moving toward a bigger and bigger government, no matter what party is in charge. I tend to believe, though, Charlie, that I actually don't believe it's terribly important who the Democrats nominate, because I just think there's such strong resistance to Trump. Mm-hmm. And the polling I've seen shows they want to beat him more than even fall in love with a candidate. We'll see.
So what is your reaction to the Joe Biden launch? Two things happened, I think, in the last 24 hours that I thought were very interesting. Number one, he had, according to at least the CNN poll, got a big bump, 6-point bump that puts him way out in front of everybody else. And then he put, I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but he put out a video that heavily features Barack Obama, that if you did not know that Obama was staying out of the race, you would assume that Obama was endorsing him. I actually thought it was kind of an effective video. But so do you see him as a strong front runner, or you still have memories of Jeb and other front runners that don't last?
Yeah, it's easy to make a case that he's a Jeb or he's a Hillary. But again, I think the difference here is Trump. That half of the country, the anti-Trump part of the country, is more fired up like they've never been. Look, the truth is nobody thought Trump was going to win. So many Democrats stayed at home in 2016, Democrats, because they never figured this goof would win. There's no way on God's green earth they're going to let that happen again. So I think the resistance to Trump, I think, will lift a guy like Biden beyond a Jeb or a Hillary. And all you got to do, Charlie, is look at Trump's reaction. I mean, he can't help himself. I think Biden makes him nervous. I think he knows Biden can beat him. Biden can cut into the Wisconsins and the Michigans and the Pennsylvanias of the world. And that's his Achilles heel. If he doesn't do well, if Trump doesn't do well there, it's game over. I think Trump's people know that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. And I was as I was watching the launch of the campaign, I know that it's conventional wisdom that Joe Biden is a gaffe machine, which of course he is. But you do pick up things over 40 or 50 years in politics. Yes. And he basically managed to check every box for various Democratic constituencies. I mean, look, there's a variety of things. Bernie Sanders is going to hit him on votes on trade, and other folks are going to hit him for Anita Hill. But those don't strike me as existential threats, especially if he can have these videos in which basically he stands behind Barack Obama, because that's the one thing that's going to unite at least the Democratic base.
Look, you and I probably agree. I wish that we had a very energetic, aggressive primary challenge to Trump.
Oh, yeah.
I love Bill Weld, but Bill Weld's not that. So Republicans who don't like Trump are probably not going to have an alternative in the primary. But Republicans who don't like Trump in the general election, Joe Biden is probably the only Democrat who they would cross over for, I think.
At the moment, yeah. I mean, they may force him to the left, make him toxic as well. What about how do you feel about Mayor Pete? How do you feel about Mayor Pete?
I think he's a fascinating guy. I think he's brilliant. I wish we had, again, I disagree with him on probably virtually every issue, but I wish we had somebody hopeful and aspirational like that. I think he's a really intriguing candidate. I don't know that the Mayor Pete magic is going to last, but I think he's Charlie, when I was there in Congress, all the energy was with the Tea Party, sometimes to the extreme. The energy in the Democrat Party is really over there on the left, and Mayor Pete can kind of balance. He comes across as more moderate, but I think on the stances, he's every bit as progressive as a lot of them. This, by the way, I think is an issue that Biden's going to have to deal with, is addressing all that energy on the left, and how does he at least tap into it?
Yeah, no, obviously he's got to do that in order to make people not stay home. No, I think I think I had this conversation. I don't know who
it
was
with. What do you think about him?
I'm impressed with him. I'm impressed with his intelligence. Yeah. I'm impressed with his demeanor. Even on those issues, and I agree with you, I disagree with him on the substance of a lot of these issues. But at least I feel that he and I could sit in a room and have a discussion, a respectful discussion, as opposed to, you know, the kind of, you know, in your face, so you must be a Nazi type of discussion that others might have.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, there is – I think I was talking with Tom Nichols about all of this. When I saw him, and I'm impressed with this, so don't misunderstand me. When he was speaking in perfect French, reacting to Notre Dame, I was thinking, oh, my God, he's screwed, because, of course, there's so many people who think that that's elitist, you know. So the Democrats have traditionally had a beer lane and a wine lane. And I talked with Rick Wilson about this the other day, and he's sort of like the champagne lane, although Rick had a much more colorful phrase for it. And I wonder whether or not this is his year. He just has a feel that he's going to do very well. He's going to be respectful. He will be acceptable to everybody, but he's not going to break through. He's not going to be the guy to knock off Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, or Joe Biden. But who knows?
Maybe not, unless he's tapped into something. These are weird, kind of even revolutionary times we're living in. Look, Obama came out of nowhere. None of us thought a guy like Trump would get elected. In many ways, this young 37-year-old is the perfect antidote to Trump. He's young. He's empathetic. He's smart. It'll be interesting to see if he can do it, but he's certainly tapped into something that I think the Democrat Party loves, and I think a lot of independents would like.
Well, you're right, and you know, it's funny you should say this, because I was thinking about this today, the extent to which society, technology, and politics is changing so fast that we don't even understand sometimes how quickly and how fundamentally things have changed. So almost any analogy to the past, so any discussions, and I love having these discussions, is this 1970, you know, 1972, McGovern versus Nixon, or this is going to be more like 2000? You know, it's like talking about, so this is going to be like the election of 1844 or more like 1881, whatever. Yeah. It's irrelevant. Because the dynamic has changed, what people care about changes, how people get their information changes, and so you're right. That's the election of Trump should have made us deeply humble about our ability to understand American politics. But you see some of these trends, the way in which people are lining up, and who knows? I mean, the notion of a gay candidate for president would have been shocking just a few years ago. And yet, look, maybe America is ready.
It's an asset now. Yeah, I think it's an asset now. And I watched his speech a couple weeks ago when he formally announced he was running. And there he was up there with his husband, and he kissed his husband. And look, I'm 100% straight, but I looked at that and I thought to myself, that's really kind of cool. And in fact, I think that's a selling feature for him. Just like I think if Obama wasn't black, Charlie, with his background, I don't even know that he would have run for president.
Yeah,
it became an asset. America was ready for it. I really do think, because Trump is probably the most intolerant, close-minded guy we've ever had in the White House. I just think there's a yearning for real tolerance out there, and Mayor Pete may be carried by something like that.
It could be. It could be. And although the image of him sitting and having lunch with Al Sharpton, I have to say that did make me wince. But but by the way, I am not one to throw stones, because I was on a TV set sitting next to Reverend Al last week, and I was like, deep breath here, man, deep breath. But he actually, speaking of picking up things over the years, didn't say anything that I thought was particularly unreasonable. Okay, so do you have any thoughts on Rod Rosenstein? Because I'm looking at this Wall Street Journal report about his letter of resignation, which apparently includes the line, quote, "I am grateful to you for the opportunity to serve, for the courtesy and humor you often display in our personal conversations."
I apologize if this is inappropriate. I want to punch him. I want to punch Rosenstein because I'm frustrated, because it's like I don't know what camp he's in. If you're going to be a Trump acolyte and be a proud Trump acolyte, then be it. And if you're going to be a guy who hates Trump and you're going to stand for the rule of law, then be that. But I want to punch Rosenstein because I can't figure out what camp he's in. And I think he's like a wussy. He just sort of goes back and forth. That letter was nauseating.
Well, and it comes, a few days after that report that we'd heard that he'd gone in and, tearfully told the president, "I'm on your team. Let me land this plane," and rather remarkably saved his job, sent some sort of signal to Trump that he was going to be loyal. And I guess I found that to be disillusioning. But, Matt Miller used to be the spokesman for the Department of Justice, and he's often on NBC. And his theory has always been, in answer to your question, he says, look, Rod Rosenstein is weak. He has always been weak. And if you need to understand what this dynamic is, it is the fact that he is a weak actor, that he does not stand up. He's incapable of standing up. And throughout this process, even though he had moments when he looked like he was doing the right thing, and perhaps maybe did do the right thing, he was never going to be the stalwart for the principle of the rule of law. And I think that becomes more obvious in retrospect.
So is it safe to assume that Trump always sensed that Rod was weak? Because I would imagine Trump sensed that early and took advantage of that.
Well, you think about this meeting. His job is on the line, because it reported that he was telling people to wear a wire in the 25th Amendment, and everybody was figuring he's dead, he's toast, he's out. He goes in the meeting and he says something to Trump that saves his job. Now we find out that what he said was this, he's cheerfully like, come on, there's no crying in Department of Justice, right? I mean, there's no crying in the rule of law. Right. And, tells him that don't count on me. I'm the guy. I'm the guy who will land the plane. So look at it from Trump's point of view, which I know is always very dangerous. I never try to get inside Trump's head. But clearly he's sitting there going, this guy has basically come in to suck up to me and tell me that I am on my team. And in Trump world, what does that mean? That means that you are going to be loyal and that you're going to deliver what he wants. Yeah. And I think that's exactly at least that's my take at the moment. And then you go back and you think of that picture of him standing, woodenly behind Bill Barr. Well, Bill Barr is lying about the Mueller report, and you go, okay, now the pieces are coming together. That little jigsaw puzzle is coming together.
Will the Democrats impeach eventually, you think, yay or nay?
What an interesting question. I mean, ask me, again tomorrow. Maybe yesterday I would have said, you know, okay, I don't know what I would have said yesterday, but it might be something different than the day before. Part of me thinks they just can't resist it, that he's almost egging them on. This whole, I am not going to cooperate with you on anything. It's almost like he's daring them to impeach. What do you
think? Well, don't you, Charlie, don't you think he, I think he'd like impeachment. I think he considers it to be his saving grace.
No, I think that's plausible because that's the ultimate. I am the victim. I'm the victim. They're coming after me. They you know, I am your president. And we've seen this in the past. People will rally around. They'll circle the wagons. They will. The harder you push against them, the more, the more vigorously they will defend. That's certainly possible. On the other hand, there are these grown-ups in the Democratic Party, and I never thought I would say this, and I'm sure you never thought you'd say it in this conversation, but, you know, grown-ups like Nancy Pelosi, who seem to understand how dangerous that is, that in fact, you know, that this would not help them in 2020. So I think that those – they will try to steer the ship, you know, between those rocks – have the high-profile hearings, do the investigations, but hold the impeachment card for the very as the very last resort. But who knows?
And the only fly in that ointment is if Trump continues to defy the Constitution and basically ignore Congress, he may leave them with no choice.
Yeah.
And I actually think that's part of what he's doing is because I do think he wants impeachment. He wants to be the victim and he wants to be the story. Trump's going to have a real hard time during the first half of this campaign because a lot of the attention is going to be on all these Democrat candidates. Trump would dry up and wither away if he wasn't the main story every day. Impeachment also would make him the main story.
And he likes being the martyr. And as you know, on the right, many, many years ago, in the early 1990s, I wrote a book called A Nation of Victims, which was talking about a lot of it was about folks on the left, the progressives, who were saying this group's victim is, we need to, adopt some victim model for this group. It's fascinating to me to watch the extent to which people on the right, conservatives, have become really comfortable playing that victim card. It's not my fault. I'm not responsible. They did it. I was actually on a Canadian radio show this morning with a guy whose name you would recognize. We were talking about some of the problems of the NRA, and it was like, no, there's no problems. There's no problems whatsoever. It's all been done to them. And it was like, okay, so, but yes, going back to it, yes, Republicans and Donald Trump would love that particular model. And of course, then the entire election becomes about that. Now, on the other hand, I really do appreciate the argument that if Congress does not exercise its impeachment oversight, then what is doing two things. It is abrogating it's abdicating its constitutional responsibility. It is allowing the president to be literally above the law. And politically, it would run the risk of normalizing his behavior, basically saying, okay, we'd rather talk about socialized medicine than talk about the fact that we have this guy who has been credibly accused of obstruction of justice sitting in the Oval Office.
When you and I pull ourselves out of the trees and think about what we learned 12 days ago, that this president welcomed and encouraged Russian interference. He lied and lied and lied. He ordered other people to lie. He obstructed justice. He put his own interest ahead of the country's. I mean, when you add all that up, Charlie, I mean, come on. How can you not move toward impeachment? It's all right there. But I know politically it's difficult to do.
And you also make the point, and this has almost gotten lost in all of this, is that here you have a president who wanted to obstruct an investigation into this Russian interference, which has been now overwhelmingly documented, and it is ongoing. Yes. And he's made it very, very clear that he has no intention of making this a priority. If, in fact, we're at war, here's the president of the United States who doesn't want to talk about it, who wants to minimize it, and therefore is not fulfilling his most fundamental constitutional responsibility, which is to protect the country. So I'm increasingly concerned that he's sending this green light to Vladimir Putin. Remember last time? Remember what your return on investment was last time? Hey, have at it. Venezuela. This is playing out as we are having this conversation. It's grossly unfair to say that it is a coup, but it does appear to be an uprising by the democratic forces using aspects of the military, and it has turned hyper-violent very, very quickly. You've seen the videos of these armored trucks rolling over citizens. Now, this is one of those moments where there are folks on the left who are deciding, well, because Trump and the Republicans have favored the Democratic opposition, they must be bad. This would be one of the worst, I think, political errors to assume that simply because Trump supports something, we must be on the opposition, because this is about as clear-cut a case of we either stand with democratic forces and freedom, or we stand with one of the most brutal socialist strongmen in Central America.
Spot on, my friend. Nobody in the United States of America should be conflicted about what's going on down there right now. And everybody here should know which side we're rooting for. And you make a great point. And to me, this is a no-brainer for the Democrats to just be unified. Because at the end of the day, Charlie, nobody's going to think of this as some sort of a Trump-led movement or victory, or not even a victory, anything like that. Trump doesn't own this. This is on the Venezuelan people, and we should all get behind them.
Yeah, this is I don't know how far I want us to go. Should the United States intervene militarily down there? That strikes me as perhaps the wrong route. But short of that, I think that we need to rally the support, rally our allies, and do everything possible to provide them with political, moral, material support.
I'm with you. Short of military intervention, this is a people, I think, rising up to be free. It's on them to rise up and be free, to overtake a tyrant. Let's not forget, I mean, God love, we stand with the Venezuelan people, but they assume some responsibility allowing Chavez and Maduro and these dictators to be in charge. They're going to have to rid themselves of these people. And one other important point is the fact that they lost their freedom to arm themselves a few years back. And that's let us in America never forget again, as always, how important our Second Amendment is, because right now you've got the Venezuelan people down there today fighting back with rocks and stones.
The last time we talked, before I get to that, somebody was asking me the other day, you know, about what's been happening with conservative media and the invasion of the body snatchers. And I was explaining to them that I thought that there was incredibly difficult from just a business point of view to be a viable anti-Trump conservative, particularly in the electronic media. I mean, we're obviously trying to do this online in a variety of ways. You are one of the very few. Somebody said, well, are there any left? And I came up with, let's put it this way: if I was counting on my fingers, I didn't get to my thumb. It didn't get to five. So
I think, Charlie, last time this is your business. You know, talk radio, man. This is your world, my friend. And you're right; it is extremely difficult to do what I do on the radio. The place to be is to be a Sean Hannity or a Mark Levin, and be a 100% in Trump's pocket and say that he walks on water every day. And I can't and won't do that.
Yeah, people don't really fully understand in the age of instant feedback. The one thing I don't miss doing a daily show is any time that I would bring. And by the way, things have gotten a lot worse since I left. I mean, it has gotten, you know, times 10. But back then, I remember sitting there in front of the microphone, in front of the screen, and the moment that I would bring it up, watching the emails just come pouring in, watching the Twitter texts. And trust me, I do understand how people get up in the morning and go, I want people to like me. These are my people. Yeah. I don't want them to say, you know, that I am terrible and they're never going to listen to me again. This is not what I want to do with my life. So I understand that, but I bring it up because for two reasons. Number one, this is why I like doing podcast so much better, because nobody's listening to us right now and no one's, you know, bothering me. And and number two, that I don't have to I don't have to worry about that sort of thing. But people need to understand that the people who do what you do, it takes an awful lot of guts. The pressures are overwhelming.
Just make me a promise. If I lose my syndicated radio gig, I can be your administrative assistant. Just promise me that.
Absolutely. And by the way, I take the coffee black. No cream, no nothing.
Thank you, sir. You know what? You got to speak the truth. You do the same thing, Charlie. You got to speak the truth, what you believe.
Well, it's basically at a certain point, you're just all out of bleeps to give, you know? So, yeah. Hey, so are you a Game of Thrones fan at all?
I confess I know nothing about Game of Thrones.
All right, because I'm going to have to start asking people for predictions. Who's going to get it? I still haven't recovered from the last one, so I will not inflict that at you at all. Joe Walsh, thank you again so much for joining us once again. One of our return guests on the Bulwark Podcast. So thanks a lot.
The Bulwark rocks, Charlie. It's always an honor. Thank you, my friend.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.